I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and this hour of our show, we're going to be talking about Russia, and we have a whole lot to discuss. Today, the New York Times says the poison gas attack on Syrian civilians, many of whom were children, was reportedly perpetrated by pro-Russian, pro-Iranian murderous regime of al-Assad. We will talk about that. Our guest this hour has a recent piece in Foreign Policy, and he says that Vladimir Putin isn't a supervillain. Russia is neither the global menace nor dying superpower of America's increasingly hysterical fantasies. We'll be talking about connections between members of the Trump administration and the Putin regime. We'll talk about Vladimir Putin. We will be talking about the deaths of Russian ambassadors. And we have a whole lot more to talk about during the course of this hour. Excuse me, I got a frog in my throat. Our guest this hour is Mark Schrod. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Villanova University and received his Ph.D. in political science from University of Wisconsin-Madison. His areas of expertise include Russian politics and the politics and foreign policy of the former Soviet states. He's the author, and we've interviewed him before on this book, of the book Vodka, Politics, Autocracy, and Alcohol in Russia. What is the right narrative about Putin and Russia is the course of conversation this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, where we love to read your comments. And we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Schrod, been a while since we spoke. Thanks very much for being with us.
Yes, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we have so much to talk about. Why don't we start with this poison gas attack on Syrian civilians yesterday? New York Times reporting today that it was reportedly perpetrated by pro-Russian, pro-Iranian murderous regime of al-Assad. What do we know about the connections here?
I haven't seen too much in terms of like explicit connections between the two, other than you know the fact that the Russian regime has been supporting Assad for ages, as primarily one of Russia's top exporters or I guess importers of Russian military equipment and so on. So I think this is probably more of an issue of Assad himself and sort of the Assad regime rather than anything that's necessarily due to some sort of nefarious Russian connection there.
Mm-hmm. We obviously need to start with what's been going on with trying to uncover the role that the Russians had in supporting Donald Trump and bringing down Hillary Clinton in the election and the information that we know. From what you know about Russia, some people have said that Vladimir Putin was really behind all of this. Was he, do you think?
It's an interesting question. Obviously, I don't have sort of the insight, straight to the hotline to the Kremlin to figure these things out. But people have been asking this, including Western journalists have asked him point blank whether he's been behind this. And he actually tried in some occasions to invoke, George H.W. Bush and his, read my lips comments. And he says, no, so he's, denying all of it. But, the reality of it is, something on this scale, in terms of the complexity of sort of the interventions, the very high stakes game that's being played here, that isn't something that could go down without sort of orders from the top. And in this particular case, we're talking about the very top there.
Mm-hmm. You talk about America's hysteria over Putin in a recent piece in Foreign Policy and that hysteria mounting. Is it warranted hysteria over Russia and Putin, or are we over the top here?
In the Foreign Policy piece, I guess to rewind it a little bit, they had asked me to write a piece on Russia, essentially saying, well, we know Russia's in the news all over the place these days. We really need some sort of level-headed analysis of what its actual capabilities are. And I said, okay, I'd be happy to do that, but it's probably not going to be the kind of thing that you'd want to publish because it's not the same, the sort of thing that's going to generate a whole lot of, sort of internet clicks or eyeball, viewings of their on these web pages. Because, you know, a lot of the stuff that you do see in sort of the American political discourse about Russia does seem to be over the top. And so, looking at some of the coverage just in the weeks before I published this piece about a month ago, it seemed like everything had a nefarious Russian tie to it, right? So that, the assassination of, a Russian diplomat in Turkey suddenly has something to do with, an alleged Putin-Trump connection Putin is trying to overthrow the entire Western political order, including, the United States, and meddling in Europe and meddling with Brexit and all sorts of different things. And so it seems that, the Russia hook is the thing that people were utilizing to in some cases to generate more, internet traffic and moving on that. I was suggesting that based on what I've seen in terms of, being a consumer of American information and news media about Russia, that it seemed to fall into two broad categories of information. And for, lack of a better term, some of my internet friends, we called one of them Putler, which is a combination of Putin and Hitler. And a lot of these, these stories are just over-the-top sensationalism that Putin is the next Adolf Hitler and he'll stop at nothing. And everywhere you look is some sort of nefarious plot. The other end is what I talked about as the dying bear camp, which is essentially just the exact opposite. When you hear former President Obama saying that Russia, doesn't export anything that the rest of the world wants, and it's a, haven of corruption and crime and decay, and its demographics are abysmal, and all these sorts of things. It's like, okay, well, it's not exactly that either. Things are doing okay in Russia these days. Its economy is not completely imploding, but we have to kind of be careful not to be given to too much hyperbole in one direction or the other. The truth is probably somewhere in between.
Yeah, and yet when you have a story that is as significant as the Russians meddling in a U.S. election to favor one candidate, when you hear stories about thousands of hackers being paid by the Russians to look at voting rolls in states throughout the United States, when you look at hacking into the DNC and using that information very carefully targeted to certain voters, it is a huge story, isn't it? I mean, the influence of Russia in an American democracy, and so many people now saying they're doing the same in Europe, that's a major story.
Oh, sure. Yes, most definitely it is. I don't want to downplay that at all. I mean, the implications of this are huge for... and not just for Russian politics, Russian foreign policy, or American foreign policy towards Russia, but for very much so these sort of American domestic politics, and just our understandings of how democracy is supposed to run here in a country like the United States.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, just because some people have brought this up, and you mentioned it in your article as well, the dead Russians. Clinton Watts from the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing last week, saying there have been more dead Russians in the past 3 months that are tied to this investigation, the possible coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia. They're dropping dead, even in Western countries, at least 8 Russian politicians, activists, ambassadors, and a former intelligence official have died since the U.S. election. And one of these, who was found dead in a car in Athens, I believe, the reports are that he may have been a source of information in that 35-page dossier that detailed alleged links between the Trump campaign and Russia. So are we paying too much attention here? Is this conspiracy theories? Some of this, you raise these questions. They seem to be legitimate questions about what's going on.
Right, and I think the trick here is, they talk about determining or teasing out the signal from all the noise that's out there. Whether or not such and such person had information of a sensitive nature and that could have led to some sort of, some sort of unfortunate end is hard to know without, sort of a greater insight into this information. But, when it comes to other things like the former ambassador to the United Nations, Vitaly Churkin, he was he was actually fairly old, and he drank a lot, you know, so it's like, all right, well, are we going to necessarily chalk that one up to nefarious influence, or are we going to chalk it up to the fact that it's an old guy who died, you know, so... So it's hard for us to try to determine these sorts of things. And, you know, my misgiving that I have with it is, you know, I'm on the internet as well as everybody else and trying to sift through these, is that almost immediately when you hear of something, you know, that sounds nefarious, you know, the allegation is there and the question is raised whether or not there is some sort of relationship to the, you know, the ongoing investigation between, about, you know, alleged Russian ties. You know, I read one article, I think it was on the BBC a couple of weeks ago, you know, and the headline read something that, you know, that there was a Russian lawyer fell out of, I think it was a seventh-story window or something along those lines, and they were alleging that this had something to do with the Trump connection. Well, as it turns out, you know, is buried at the very end of the story that, you know, he was representing somebody who, you know, three steps removed might have had something to do with an ongoing investigation. But he had his own sort of demons. He had his own, things that might have taken him off track. He was an anti-corruption investigator, which is a very dangerous business domestically if you're in Russia, or something along those lines. And so, you know, I'm always interested. I'm paying attention to these things, but mm-hmm. I'm kind of hesitant to automatically jump to the conclusion that that just because somebody dies, it's automatically due to some sort of Putin-Trump connection.
Mm-hmm. So how hard is it to find the truth? You know Russia pretty well, and let's center on the former intelligence official who was found dead in his car in Athens, who may have been a source for that 35-page dossier. Is it hard to get records in Russia to find out if indeed that is true? Because if it is true, it's a significant death.
Right, that would be something that I don't think I could answer with any degree of insider knowledge. I mean, when it comes to doing research, you know, I usually end up in archives and whatnot. You know, when it comes to finding specific sources of government information, that's going to be something that is often going to be, you know, classified information, and would have to be part of either some sort of intelligence gathering, you know, sort of capacity, either within Russia or internationally. And that's why I guess we have these spy networks. This is why we have, you know, the CIA operating in different places. And so, mm-hmm. So yeah, it'll be interesting to determine and see what these connections ultimately are. But at the moment, I'm just kind of on the sidelines watching it all unfold like a spectator, just like anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Professor Shroud, you ask in the piece in Foreign Policy, is Putin's regime really as threatening and omnipresent as it is cracked up to be? Is it threatening?
The conclusion I come to in the article is that, you know, it's not the omnipresent threat. It's not about to, you know, and some of the, I guess, the anti-Russian hysteria, if you're looking at it, and not just strictly from an American perspective, but from a European perspective, you got people very nervous up and down Eastern Europe, you know, essentially from Finland is worried that Russia might invade. The Swedes have actually called up military reserves. You know, the Baltic states are you know, kind of leery about this looming threat of Russia, and Belarus is. And so up and down, everybody's worried that, you know, Russia could, you know, potentially mobilize into a more of an overt sort of military threat. And I don't see that as being necessarily the case. I mean, they had a very difficult time sort of even when they were mobilizing on the border with Ukraine and supporting these breakaway republics beginning in 2014. You know, that was a significant drain on their resources just to mobilize, you know, some units within their own territory. You know, far be it to suggest what the impacts would be, not only of sort of provoking a European war, but also sort of having to fund it and maintain it for a long period of time. I just don't see that, you know, military capacity as quite matching the rhetoric that we oftentimes have when it comes to the Russian threat.
Mm-hmm. What about cyber capability?
Yeah, cyber capability is a completely different animal because, as we're finding out, as this whole thing goes on, is that, you know, you can do this fairly well on the cheap. You know, Russia has the resources. You know, you already have sort of cyber espionage capabilities. And even when it comes to, you know, some of these stories that we have, you know, which aren't exactly new about these, like, you know, troll armies that, you know, Moscow has, you know, this is not an extremely expensive outlay of money to have 1,000 people working in a in a warehouse in St. Petersburg, typing up tweets at the United States. And so it does seem to be a very sort of cost-effective measure on their part to get sort of the biggest bang for their buck or for their ruble, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the recent protests that took place. What were those all about?
That's very, very interesting. And it's kind of taken people a little bit by surprise that you have, well, I guess the political season is upon us. That beginning in 2018, Vladimir Putin will be going up for re-election as Russian president. And in sort of anticipation of this, you had Russia's probably most widely known anti-corruption figure, a guy named Alexei Navalny, who's one of these guys who goes out and goes to the streets and encourages people to protest and whatnot. He's been moving more and more into sort of electoral politics. He ran for the governorship of Moscow a few years ago and actually had quite a bit of popular support. He vowed that he's going to challenge Putin in the 2018 elections. But one of the favored, tactics of the Putin regime is to maintain power by discrediting your opposition, and they've been trying to discredit him by dragging his name through the mud and putting him in jail for mm-hmm. For all sorts of corruption and so on. Anyway, so Navalny, this was about a month and a half ago, publishes this and he runs. See, I should preface this. He also runs an in-house anti-corruption investigation unit, very much based upon open source technology. People can, if there are, government contracts or government tenders that look really suspicious, like they're written up for one particular vendor and they close really quickly, those sorts of things that, set off alarm bells for high-level corruption, people could, essentially submit those and they'd have lawyers looking through these sorts of things and sniff them out. Now, so Navalny, about a month ago, publishes this YouTube video. It's about 50 minutes long. And as I see it now, it's up over 70 million hits.
Oh my gosh!
It's 50 minutes long. It's a very, very well done expose of the high level corruption, not of Putin, but of Putin's number two guy, the former president, Dmitry Medvedev. And so, if you Google Navalny Medvedev or Navalny Dimon, D-I-M-O-N. It should take you not only to his, this video on YouTube, which has English subtitles, if you're interested in watching it. It's very, very good. But also to his correspondence, his corresponding online website, and where he has all the supporting information for the video that he shows. And so over the course of, 50 minutes, he does almost kind of like a John Oliver routine and highlights all of these sort of nefarious ties between, the head of the United Russia Party, which is, Dmitry Medvedev, and he's, sort of Putin's prime minister, and all these different things, how many yachts he owns, on a very meager government salary, how he, has all these high-level, palaces in various places throughout Russia, and how he owns, you can trace the ownership of Tuscan vineyards to this guy. And so he's got it all there. He's got all the documentation, all the information. And it was really sort of a wake-up call. And the way he does this is not only just to show that, okay, we've got some very nefarious high-level corruption, but he juxtaposes it against the sort of suffering of your everyday, common farmer or peasant in Russia. And at the very end, he essentially encourages people that, if you're fed up with this sort of thing, and you have these clips of Medvedev in that he utilizes very effectively, saying, well, unfortunately, we don't have money for that. We don't have money for mm-hmm. education and roads and so on. But at the same time, we're looking at his, palatial estates, which run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. Essentially he says, well, if you're sick up, sick and fed up of this, why don't you protest? We'll have a nationwide protest on this given date. And nobody really thought too much about it, especially in the West. They thought, well, you get some of the diehard anti-corruption folks out there. But really, it wasn't just the sort of metropolitan areas of Moscow and St. Petersburg that showed up for this, but you had people showing up in protests across the country.
Interesting.
Big cities and small. And so that was really wake-up call. Some people are suggesting that this might be either a turning point or something that is quantifiably, or I guess, a difference in kind from the protests that we had with previous election cycles, most recently in 2011 and 2010 and 2011.
Mm. So he's on his way to winning an election or not?
I doubt it, but he's part of the political process, to be sure. I think the electoral politics in Russia is still so heavily slanted towards to the Kremlin and the executive branch with Putin, and Putin is still very much liked. He still has public approval ratings upwards of 80%. So it's going to be a very hard a very hard slog for anybody, especially sort of a loathed outsider who's not exactly has the same sort of access to information or access to resources that a Kremlin insider would. It's going to be very, very hard for him to get involved. But he's already demonstrating that he can influence the discussion. He can influence the political discourse, and even encourage somebody as high as Putin's number two guy. People are calling for his head. People are asking him to step down, and he's not doing it, but it's definitely had an impact on the political discourse.
80% approval rating for Putin, why?
A lot of it is, a lot of good questions there. All sorts of different threads to kind of unwind. One is that, he came to power in 2000 after the horrible years of the 1990s with President Boris Yeltsin. And sort of by dint of timing, he sort of caught the wave of the massive increase in global oil prices that kind of continued up and up throughout, the entire decade of the 2000s. And so people essentially saw their lives getting better under him. Suddenly, they can go from being utterly destitute during Yeltsin in the 1990s to, being able to afford an apartment and a car, and maybe they can vacation abroad. And so, there's that sense of stability, that sense of increasing prosperity that kind of went with that, and sort of the economic legitimation that comes with this. And the problem is, especially after the invasion of into Crimea and Ukraine, the Russian economy certainly has cooled off because it's not riding the ever increasing global oil prices that had kind of rocketed Putin to these astronomical heights. So some people have suggested that that might be a reason why he's turning to sort of this very hardcore kind of right-wing nationalism to bolster his support, because sort of the economic legitimacy isn't there anymore. He can't exactly deliver the goods when Russia's economy is in mired in a recession. So he's looking for other reasons for people to support him. And I think there is something to that, not necessarily that it's a motivator for Russian foreign policy, but I do think there is something to the need to have a very large base of support. And I think Russians largely are prone to that because the difference I've noticed in terms of state and society relations between the United States and Russia. In Russia, I think these are things that have come out of some of my discussions with my Russian friends for a long time. In the United States, there's this kind of sense that the government works for us, that, it's the individual, it's society that should be served by the state. In Russia, I get the sense that it's the other way around, that the purpose of society is to serve the state. And so the state in this particular case is, symbolically led by Vladimir Putin. And so if you're going to be a good patriotic citizen, you should be behind Putin, even if, he might not be delivering the goods as much anymore. That's still part of sort of nationalism, is to stand behind your country, which means standing behind its leader.
We are going to welcome phone calls. We have Russia up for discussion this hour, and there's a whole lot to talk about. As you can tell, we're looking at Putin's favorability ratings, the protests that took place in cities all over Russia, anti-corruption demonstrations, what those mean about how happy people are with the way things are in Russia. We are looking at Russian meddling in the U.S. election. We have yet to talk, and we will, a bit more about ties between members of the Trump administration and Russia, and what those may be, and the thoughts that Putin has shared about Donald Trump and what Donald Trump has said about Vladimir Putin and the investigations going on in this country concerning the possible coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia. And we're welcoming your phone calls. Our phone number and our guest, in case you're just tuning us in, is Professor Mark Schrod. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Villanova University. His latest book is Vodka Politics, Autocracy and Alcohol in Russia, and he received his PhD in political science from UW-Madison. Here is our phone number. What do you think about Putin? What do you think about the meddling in the election? Do you think that we are becoming a bit hysterical about Russia, or do you see reason for us to be hysterical about it? What do you make of all these dead Russians? Are these conspiracy theories, or are some of these deaths that you look at and you have a lot of suspicions about what's really going on here? What is the right narrative about Vladimir Putin and Russia this hour? 800-486-8655 is our number. Lines are open for you right now. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We like to read your messages there. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. All right, phone calls for Professor Mark Schrod, 800-486-8655. We start with Kathy in Black Duck, Minnesota. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. On the night of the election, I was, after it was announced that Donald Trump won, I was watching actually the Russian parliament, and they discussed very cheerily that, and this is a quote, they were going, "Congratulations to our good friend Donald. Democracy is dead." Now, this video stayed online for approximately 24 hours before it disappeared and was replaced with one with that he beat Grandma. And I'm wondering if anybody else saw this video. I've run into a few online that have, but most people say that it's not true, but it was the Russian parliament.
Professor Schrod.
Yeah, I haven't seen that specific video, but I do remember, again, as the election results were being finalized here in the United States, I spent some time watching the Russian reaction, and you did have a number of folks in the Russian parliament. The Russian parliament, essentially at the announcement that Trump had won, did burst pretty much into spontaneous applause. Across, there are a number of significant political divisions within the Russian party politics and within the Russian parliament. And you did have kind of across the board a general support for Trump. And I think part of that is not so much to be pro-Trump as it was to be anti-Hillary, because Hillary Clinton had been, as Secretary of State, had been kind of the source of every Russian anti-American conspiracy theory that you could imagine. Everything bad that happened in Russia, conspiracy theories would say it was because of Hillary Clinton back during the Obama days. And so I think there was that element to it. There was certainly celebration. I don't know about whether or not they said anything about democracy dying. But what's fascinating about that is that during this the past few months, Trump has dominated Kremlin state-run media, dominated the news cycles, dominated the televisions, until a couple of weeks ago, where apparently it's been handed down from on high that we need to really lighten up on the Trump coverage, the pro-Trump coverage, because he may not be giving us all that we would want in terms of we being, I guess, the Russian domestic, Russian, Kremlin politics. Might not be able to deliver on some of the things that they would want out of a fruitful U.S.-Russian relationship, like taking down the anti-Russian economic sanctions that have been imposed since the invasion of Crimea back in 2013-2014.
Well, they've got to be a little concerned about all the investigation that's going on, although some would say it's not enough, but what's going on in the Senate Intelligence Committee and what the FBI is looking at, that must spook the Russians, doesn't it?
Oh, sure. It does. Not just spooking them, but also the reality is, for whatever, you know, Putin wanted or whatever Russia wanted, I guess the Kremlin wanted in terms of a fruitful U.S.-Russian relationship, and whatever, you know, Trump wanted out of that. The reality is that with this huge degree of scrutiny that's going into every single element of, you know, every part, every sort of member of Trump's inner circle, you know, it's going to be extremely difficult for President Trump to make good on any of those promises.
Right.
Anything that even has a whiff of improving relations with Putin is going to be, you know, roundly decried, not just by Democrats, but increasingly by a larger number of Republicans and you know, skeptical independents across the board.
Mm-hmm. So what do you make of this? We don't know a whole lot, and I guess we'll learn more maybe about the relationship between Trump and Putin. But let's get your response to some of what's been said. Putin's comments about Trump, he's colorful and talented. Trump calls the Putin compliment an honor, even though the Russian ties are a campaign issue in 2016. Trump refuses to renounce Putin. A guy calls me a genius, Trump says, and I'm going to renounce. I'm not going to renounce him. In July, a news conference and tweets, Trump says he has nothing to do with Russia. I don't know who Putin is. I've never spoken to him. I have zero investments in Russia, but we don't know about that because we don't have tax forms. What do you make of what they said about each other?
It's been interesting to watch. Obviously, I kind of take everything that Trump says with a grain of salt because it's hard to tell what's true when he says at one point in time he doesn't have any relationship with Putin, and in other times he's saying that he's, you know, Putin's best friend, you know, going back to 2013 or whatnot. What's interesting, you know, is the other side of this. Apparently, in response to a question that was asked, I guess early on in the political cycle about Donald Trump, you know, Putin called him, I guess he called him, the Russian word is yarky, which means, I guess it could mean bright or brilliant in those ways, but it also can mean kind of, you know, over the top, sort of vivid.
Mm.
Or in some ways even like clownish.
Hmm.
So it's a very loaded term. So if you want to, you know, say that yarky means, you know, that you're a bright guy, or, you know, that would be one way of looking at it. It's a very loaded term, and so if you want to read, you know, a very positive spin into it, you can. If you want to read a negative spin into it, you can. I think it's probably a little bit of both in terms of, you know, sort of the beauty of the Russian language there.
Kathy, thanks for your call. Marcus in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Strasvoytie, Professor. I would just like to know why we, and by we I mean the United States Americans, are not more concerned about two particular developments, one a little more recently, one a little bit further back. In July of 2013, the Kremlin went on a spree to try and purchase as many electronic typewriters as they could get their hands on, which seems like that they're trying to move their archives offline so that we can't actually hack them the same way that that Snowden was able to hack us. And then the second thing that I'm wondering about, how come in the United States just recently we received very little news media coverage of the Russians demonstrating and test firing a hypersonic missile which travels at 4,600 miles per hour, and it was barely a news blip in this country?
Mark.
Those are, you know, two very interesting you know, and very different perspectives here. I guess we'll start with the latter one. The missile testing is obviously interesting, but it does seem to get buried in the news cycle when there are so many other, I guess, more sexy topics that are out there in terms of potential collusion with Russia and Trump. So I guess it's not surprising that there hasn't been more coverage of it. You know, that is seems to be another step in Russian military technology, and there have been others as well. Not only developments of Russian military technology, but suggestions that the deployment of some of these weapons would be in violation to established international law and international treaties that date back to the end of the Cold War. And so that seems to be like a lower level concern at this point. I think if we were in anything approximating sort of a normal news cycle or era in American politics, that probably would be a very high priority issue that's there. But just given everything else that's sort of on the political agenda these days, it seems to slip down pretty far. And it's, again, part of this is sort of the renewal of Russian investments in their military. Some of it's upgrading outdated infrastructure and weaponry, and some of it is just doing what we do, and that's kind of come up with a new generation of military technology. And the United States does this, Russia does this. There were, I guess, between the two of us, we're the top exporters of military wear to everybody else in the world. So. So I don't, see anything particularly nefarious about that, which is not to say that I don't see it as potentially dangerous down the line. This is, seems to have taken a backseat to some of these other ones.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
But the other one, I guess, about the...
typewriters.
The typewriters, which is crazy because that's what I do in my spare time. I repair old typewriters.
Do you really?
Yeah, it's just a hobby of mine. But I hadn't actually heard anything about the typewriters things. What's interesting about Russia in terms of, especially if you're talking about, you mentioned the term archives. A lot of Russian archives are actually becoming increasingly digitized, increasingly open, but that's very selective. In terms of what sensitive information might be out there. It's going to be very difficult for anybody to get a handle on these sorts of things. I'm not sure if going, back to the old paper routes, which, typing everything up is going to necessarily make it any more secure for them, or at least any more efficient, given their high level sort of sophistication in information technologies. But then again, I wouldn't put it past them. So mm-hmm. And plus, like I said, I'm a typewriter lover. So,
You haven't had any Russian intelligence officers ask to buy your typewriters?
No, unfortunately. No.
You might get a good price for them, right?
Yeah, who knows?
Who knows? No. Thanks, Marcus, for the call. Elaine in Colfax, hi.
Hi. I think if there is such a thing as an evil genius, it's Putin. He's very capable of planning the interference in our presidential election and using Trump, his debt to Russian oligarchs, to control him completely. There's nothing bizarre about this. It's real. This is extraordinarily dangerous. This is the most crucial test of our democracy, our ability to do investigative journalism, to use the judiciary, to have the public get as informed as they possibly can, because Putin is that good or that bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that there's all kinds of evidence from Manafort, who was a go-between Ukrainian pro-Putin candidate, and how in the world did he end up leading a campaign of a presidential candidate in the first place? There's just evidence all over the place, and once they connect the dots and the money, they're going to. I think it will be treason. I don't think it'll just be corruption. I think it will be treason.
Thanks very much for the call. You had Congressman Castro, who I believe is on the House Intelligence Committee, which God knows what they're doing right now, but you had him yesterday saying that he thinks, and he's seen all the intelligence here, that members of this administration are going to jail over this. We haven't talked very much about all of this, but there are so many Russian connections. It is weird, isn't it?
It is weird. In a lot of ways, it is. It's a question of where there's smoke, there's fire, and geez, there's a whole lot of smoke coming out of this Russian Trump connection, especially out of the administration. So, and it seems like there are, I guess any one particular tie is hard to suggest is really nefarious, right? So, meeting with the Russian ambassador, Kislyak. Seems to be a big thing that people are like, oh, that's horrible that you can have these meetings. Well, that's what ambassadors are supposed to do. I've met with Kislyak. He seems like a nice guy, but nobody really cares because that's just me. But it does seem to get to the point where you've got so many of these coincidences, piling up in terms of, sort of these back channels that are being mm-hmm. disclosed in terms of, high-profile folks in different places in the Trump campaign. It's hard to wrap your mind around that this is all just a coincidence and that there is no signal there of any sort of either agreement or potential collusion between the Russians and Donald Trump.
More phone calls momentarily, and we have a couple lines open. They've been crowded. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Mark Schrod is our guest, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Villanova University, and his special areas are Russian politics and the politics and foreign policy of the former Soviet states. He's the author of Vodka Politics, Autocracy and Alcohol in Russia, and he received his, a lot of people on this show with Wisconsin connections, his PhD from UW-Madison. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. Rich in Rhinelander is our next caller. Hi, Rich.
Thanks. I was trying to recall, I think back in February, Putin called for greater collaboration on the military level in the fight on terrorism. And now we have these recent developments with the Assad government in Syria. But it seems to me there's a divide between high-ranking military, some of them, well, I mean, all of them are basically serving this administration, but there are some that are actually appointees. And there seems to be a divide, as far as I can tell, between military men with a lot of military experience, as far as their fondness for Putin and Russian politics goes, and President Trump and Vice President Pence and Steve Bannon and whoever the, you know, Kellyanne Conways of the world, and whoever else talks so positively about, oh, we should really be aiming for greater and greater cooperation and coordination between Russia and the United States. I'm wondering what your guest thinks about that, if there is a real divide.
Yeah, I think there certainly is that divide. I can't speak as much to the military aspects of it, but I remember, you know, shortly after the election, going to a conference down in Washington D.C. and meeting a lot of my longtime friends and colleagues who were working in government, and they just didn't know what to do. People in the State Department, people in different capacities, about this whole rhetoric of suddenly, wanting the United States to be chummy with Russia. And because you have a lot of people in high positions of power, both within the military-industrial complex, within the State Department, within other places, that their whole bread and butter is opposing Russia. Mm-hmm. Essentially they've done it their entire lives. And so, suddenly just flipping a switch and saying, okay, we're not going to consider Russia to be a threat anymore, and we're going to try to cooperate with them very closely, is, from the very beginning was going to run into a lot of opposition from very entrenched, resources within Washington, D.C., not only the military, but again, sort of State Department and other places as well.
Let's get your reaction. This is, and he's been probably one of the more vocal members of Congress, Senator John McCain. A lot of people have kind of not looked very carefully at what's going on with Russia. So others are very concerned. Let me ask if you think that his comments were warranted here, his anger is warranted. Senator John McCain, this was in February 7th of this year, he is giving an emotional speech on the Senate floor, slamming Vladimir Putin and referencing Vladimir Karamurza, the vocal critic of Kremlin policies, who was poisoned more than once. Here's Senator McCain, and then I'd like, Mark, for you to respond to what he has to say.
Vladimir knew that Putin is a killer, and he's a killer, and he might very well be the next target. Vladimir knew that there was no moral equivalence between the United States and Putin's Russia. I repeat, there is no moral equivalent between that butcher and thug and KGB colonel and the United States of America, the country that Ronald Reagan used to call a shining city on a hill. And to allege some kind of moral equivalence between the two is either terribly misinformed or incredibly biased. Neither can be accurate in any way.
Is he spot on? Is Putin a butcher and a thug?
Yes and no. I think he's a little bit over the top in terms of his delivery, but I think the message is right. I do think he's right in terms of, you know, not being a moral equivalence between the United States and Russia. But also trying to recognize that, you know, there are a lot of these issues that need to be sorted out. And I think McCain has been at the forefront of pushing for sort of, you know, the nonpartisan or bipartisan investigations into the extent of these, you know, sort of collusions or alleged collusions between the Trump campaign and Russia.
Rich, thanks so much for your call. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello. I just have a couple comments. First, I'm going to go way back to the Cuban Missile Crisis. I had a professor at UWM named Dr. Takhmakov. He was from the British intelligence during World War II. When the Cuban Missile Crisis hit, he disappeared for about 8 weeks. And, of course, I was draft age at that time, and we were all concerned about this. He came back, and in the first class period, he put us at ease, and I've kept this with me ever since. He said, "We don't have to worry about actual, if we had an armed conflict with Russia at the time, NATO could take care of Russia, and they only have the one railroad across the country." Now, over the years, I'm sure a lot of this has changed. But with the escalations that Trump is doing and all these other things, I'm wondering if that viewpoint has changed at all. And incidentally, he interviewed, Takhmakov interviewed the killers of Rasputin and wrote his doctoral thesis on Kerensky.
All right, Mark.
Interesting stuff. I teach a course here at Villanova, and sometimes we have these what they call lifelong learners come into the class, and people who've maybe of retirement age, and will share their experiences. And I was teaching one just a year or so ago, and I had a student come in, and when we were talking about Kerensky in particular, says, "Yeah, I met Kerensky." I'm thinking, how old are you? Going back to the 19-teens. But, somebody like Kerensky had been around and had actually been, after being kicked out of Russia, had been in the United States for many years and had sort of gone on speaking tours right up until his death in the 1960s. And so those historical roots, I think, are very interesting to see, in terms of our perceptions of Russia and high-level Russians going way back. Now, about the sort of the Cuban Missile Crisis and this perspective that sort of we could take the Russian army, I think if it were, if their nuclear weapons weren't a factor in any of this, I think that's 100% true. I mean, the American military machine vastly outstrips Russia in every sort of conceivable notion, aside from, the nuclear stockpiles, where there's a greater sense of parity between the two. And obviously, the nuclear card is the big one when it comes to these sorts of things. And so, yeah, even in terms of, when Russia was sort of rattling sabers on the doorstep of Ukraine and, these worries that you have people in Eastern Europe getting concerned about a potential Russian invasion, that's a little bit overblown. Yeah, Russia has been investing in its, upgrading its military capabilities over the last couple of years, but still, it's not as looming and scary as it it once was. And one last thing on this,
sure.
Some of these doom and gloom scenarios that I mentioned in the article about Russia as being perhaps a dying bear or whatnot is confronts sort of the demographic reality that Russia, especially beginning in the late 1980s, early 1990s, went through something of a demographic implosion. They were just through the economic crisis, nobody was being born, and so that's the age of people who nowadays would be conscripts in the Russian army, and so even a number of years ago, it was the army itself was the one who was raising alarm bells and saying, "Hey, if this continues, we're not going to have enough people to staff our army." And so they've had a hard time getting military conscripts, and again, it's still forcible conscription in the Russian army, forcible military service, but they're having a hard time getting enough sort of men under, in arms, and enough healthy men in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Mark, it's endlessly fascinating, all of this, and we thank you so much for being with us this hour. Your work will not be dull. Probably never was, but it sure won't be going forward. Mark Schrod, our guest, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Villanova University, author of Vodka, Politics, Autocracy, and Alcohol in Russia. He got his PhD at UW-Madison. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of your calls. I apologize. We had many of them coming in. If you have a chance and have a computer, please write your comments on our Facebook page because we will read them, and then people can respond to what you had to say, too, which would be a good thing, right? So that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in Milwaukee. News is coming up from National Public Radio. And then we're going to talk about music education and the importance of learning music in schools. We'll speak with a master music educator and one of her students, Hour 2.